Hey guys, what's going on? Welcome to the show. Welcome to another episode of Action Movie Anatomy. It is a beautiful Wednesday afternoon, and we are discussing what is quite possibly the most timeless movie ever made. We are talking about Saving Private Ryan. Is it an action movie? Is it a war movie? Is it just a war movie with an hour of action? I don't know, but it's freaking amazing. We're going to break the whole thing down for you guys. We'll see you in just 1 second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom!
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah,
this is very serious.
It's this movie.
This is... I am so sorry.
What's up, everybody?
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the show.
Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy. It's the show we talk about.
Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy.
One more time. We talk action movies on the show. It's the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network dedicated to talking pop culture. Bucketfuls of pop culture. That's the new slogan.
That's the new bucketfuls of pop culture. I love it.
Yeah, it's the new slogan.
So it's pop culture bucketfuls.
Yeah, so it's expanded now beyond movies. There's all kinds of stuff. And here we are to talk about Saving Private Ryan. So yeah. We cover action movies on the show.
The greatest action movies of all time.
Yes, action movies that adhere to four basic rules, aside from being made after 1981, which is, again, an unofficial rule, and actually a rule that references... There's a film we're going to talk about today, specifically on this episode, that was made before 81 that is a candidate for the show.
Oh, yeah.
But that is the unofficial... The first rule is the hero always plays by their own rules. Now, this is not...
a typical hero movie.
It should be noted that, like, we're aware of the fact that comparing Saving Private Ryan and John Wick is a silly thing to do.
Absolutely.
It's not the same conversation. One movie's important, the other one's just fun.
However, making the argument on the show, I've said this for 2 years, that we would never do this movie on the show. I said it for probably about a year and a half, strongly.
Yep.
over the last 6 months, we've kind of loosened up our format just a little bit, where we've brought in more movies that seem like they fit. This movie has over an hour of action in it. There are some movies that aren't even an hour long.
Yeah.
Okay? And then in those 90-minute movies that are action, there's definitely not an hour of action in those 90-minute movies for the most part.
I feel like we've covered at least one movie on the show and it, like, classified it as action that had, like, 2 minutes of action in it.
Yeah, like The Town is a great example.
Or Crimson Tide.
Crimson Tide.
Literally doesn't have any action in it.
There are explosions of emotional action in Crimson Tide.
I think that's what I said. I think that was literally my comment. So anyway, normally we say the hero always plays by their own rules. I mean, I do think that there's a smartest guy in the room quality to Hanks in this movie.
Oh,
so,
definitely.
So, like... He kind of plays by his own rules, sort of, but, like, not really. Now, the rule number two, the hero and the villain are always the smartest people in the room. Hanks definitely is the smartest guy in the room in this movie.
And is the German guy, when I was reading all the facts, is he referred to as Steamboat Willie?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So I think he's the smartest guy in the room as well. That dude knows that Upham isn't going to hurt him.
Yeah.
He knows that that he's going to get let go.
Yeah.
And he knows to not go to the Allied forces. And the dude just... That guy ruins me.
Yeah, it's hard to... It's very difficult to use the rules to actually define this movie. Rule number three, the movie is driven by a police, military, political, or mercenary figure, of course. And four, the movie contains a minimum of one explosion. Definitely.
Yeah.
So, again, guys, we don't mean to talk about this movie as like it's an action movie to take away from it. It's just that it's one of the sweetest movies ever made.
It's one of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah, it's really... It was interesting watching this for me because you know that I just finished my top 50 movies of all time list.
Yeah, do you feel like it needs to get on there?
Well, it's top 50 favorite, so I need to really make sure that I'm clear about that for people because we had our buddy Anthony in here. I was doing an interview with him recently,
and
he loves movies, and I showed him my list, and he was dying laughing because he's like, you have Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind next to Tommy Boy. He's like, you've got Dirty Dancing ahead of Godfather Part 2. What the hell's the matter with you? He's like, Just Friends
is a valid point.
He's like, Just Friends is on here, and you didn't even put Godfather 1.
Okay, we need to have a talk with Anthony about Just Friends. He doesn't know.
But the point is, 50 movies, when you really think about it, 50 movies is like nothing. That's like no movies. So
no.
If you actually want to put anything on the list that's like a stupid comedy or just something you love that isn't a classic, it takes a slot away from something very important.
Like Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, so really interestingly, Lone Survivor is on my top 50 favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
Saving Private Ryan is not. Saving Private Ryan is a much better movie, classically, than Lone Survivor.
But you enjoy watching Lone Survivor much more.
I love Lone Survivor. There's something about Lone Survivor that when I watch it over and over again, it sticks with me and I love it. Now,
it's almost because like the end of it, even though it's depressing, is triumphant, whereas the end of this is depressing and not really that triumphant.
Yeah, it was weird. I haven't seen... This is the third time I'd seen this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was beautiful. Incredible. Yeah,
it's perfect.
Wonderful. It had the same feeling for me, almost, that it had when I watched Almost Famous again recently that I hadn't seen in a long time.
When I watched Just Friends again.
And where it was just like, wow, this is a really important, really special movie that came out when mm-hmm. I was too young to really understand how important it was. And the recency bias in the next few years, because it was so hyped,
yeah,
it kind of took away from its place in history. And now looking back on this movie, it really is as important as it seemed.
It is like absolutely perfect, and it's almost 3 hours, which is also another thing that you can never speak on movies that are that long.
Yeah,
except for some of the like the most timeless classics, like Lawrence of Arabia and like right. Ben-Hur, things like that. yeah. So should we hop in the trailer?
Yeah, I'd say so. Let's get into it.
Mr. Brian Boyd, no doubt by now you have received full information about the untimely death of your son. However, there are some personal details that
believe
I
very strongly.
No words of mine can ever.
He was a fine soldier.
Regarding the circumstances leading to his death,
I felt his loss tremendous.
Robert's commanding officer.
His heroic service to his country.
He's a great soldier, dedicated friend.
The grace of God and the aid of your
those
son,
of us
I'm alive.
Please accept my most sincere condolences.
He will live in our memories.
To you, my deepest sympathy.
Granson.
What
Colonel,
just happened?
I got something you should know about.
Yes.
These two men died in Normandy. This one at Omaha Beach.
Sean Ryan.
Gandolfini?
This one in Utah.
Really?
Peter Ryan. This?
No, no, it's a different guy.
This man was killed last week in New Guinea.
Daniel Ryan.
The three men are brothers, sir. I've just learned that this afternoon their mother is getting all three telegrams. That's not all. There's a fourth brother, the youngest. He's somewhere in Normandy. We don't know where.
This is really the trailer?
The boy's alive.
There's a different one.
We're going to send somebody to find him. And we're going to get him the hell out of there.
Action.
Some private in the 101st lost three of his brothers, and he's got a ticket home.
I'll see you on the beach.
It's not going to be easy to find one particular soldier in the whole damn war.
It's a weird trailer.
Yeah, this is like trailer 3 or something, it feels like.
Good trailer, huh?
Let's say even... Take it to...
No, you can't take the kids.
I don't know anything about Ryan. It's just a name. But if finding him so he can go home, if that earns me the right to get back to my wife, well, then that's my mission.
The greatest everyman of all time.
Tom Hanks?
I think so.
Is that your,
No.
That's what you've decided?
No.
Just gonna tweet the link here to the episode, which I hadn't done because I'm proud of this show.
I'm proud of what I have created. yeah, I mean, not my favorite trailer of the ones that came out, but still a very, very good trailer.
Yep.
I need you to introduce Thesis, and I need you to do it like slowly or something, because I have seven Thesis.
You have seven
Thesis. I have seven Thesis.
Thesis.
Theses.
I can't find the link. So a couple things. I like that trailer. I feel like there must be a more straight trailer they released.
Yeah, there's like a much more blockbuster trailer.
But
where it says where Tom Hanks has the "I'll see you on the beach" line in it.
But that's a good trailer, and I can see why they wanted to do that. It's mm-hmm. it's emotional and big and sweeping. And
yeah, I mean, someone wrote there was like that trailer is the most dramatic thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So a couple things, guys. Number one, if you want to follow along the conversation, you should get at us on Twitter. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media.
You guys can find me at Andrew Guy on Instagram and Twitter.
Yes, and you can find the Popcorn Talk at the Popcorn Talk and our podcast, Action Movie Anatomy, at AMA Podcast. We've been getting a lot of interaction on there recently from you guys, which has been super, super cool. So let's get into thesis statement, guys. Thesis statement is that moment in the film, something, a strong thought, a strong opinion, rooted almost in like hyperbole. Like you mm-hmm. almost, you want to say it, you want somebody to kind of like turn their head up and be like,
that's
interesting.
An incredible point.
Interesting. And they really have to think about it before they decide if they do or don't agree with you, because it's like a big thought. Like they care. You're
right.
At a party and you say it. They want to talk Saving Private Ryan, and this is what you say.
This is your one argument, your one point that you could back up till the end of time.
Yes. And I thought a lot about mine. It's kind of a weird one, but I think it's true.
Okay.
So I'm going to say that the monologue by Giovanni Ribisi in the church is the definitive moment of the film, and also the definitive moment of Giovanni Ribisi's career.
The moment in the church is the most definitive moment in the film, as well as Giovanni Ribisi's career.
Yes. doubles as both the definitive moment in Saving Private Ryan and Giovanni Ribisi's career. And I say that because of this. For me, aside from the action in the opener, which it's you can't really argue that the action in the opener is not the most impactful, because it is. The opening move, the opening of this movie, I mean, like, the easy thesis that I think we probably both thought about,
which is one of the ones I threw away.
Yeah, is like, this is the greatest either opening to a film, or that it's the greatest war sequence ever.
Yeah, the greatest war sequence ever, the greatest D-Day sequence ever, like, whatever it may be, that is the greatest depiction of that day, I believe, in film.
If someone says that to you at a party, you almost like don't even pay attention.
So. Yeah, I mean, like, I was talking to my friend about it, like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's not a conversation point.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know what second would be, honestly. I do think actually some of the Lone Survivor fights and them going down the hill and everything are actually pretty incredible.
Yeah, like some of the classics, like an Apocalypse Now and like Platoon and stuff like that, but still this is different.
Yeah, it's just a different level. The reason I say that is because I think so much of this movie is centered around young male GIs' relationships to their mothers and their parents. That's what so much of this movie is about. I mean, they send a group of guys to save the fifth son so that the mother doesn't get the fifth folded American flag,
right,
talking about her deceased son. And again, Vin Diesel has just died in the film. He's written a letter to his dad. Ribisi's sitting there and he's having a moment as he's copying down this letter. And there's this just kind of lingering tone in the air all throughout the film, which is that all these guys are like, I want nothing more than to see my mother again, and I may never get to see my mother again.
And I'm just a kid.
Right. Every scene, there's somebody calling out mama. There's somebody talking about their parents. That's like the whole backbone of the movie is that. Mm-hmm. And so in that moment, when Giovanni Ribisi's having the moment, he's copying down the letter and he's talking about it's. I mean, it's an incredible monologue and it brought me to tears watching it.
Yeah, me too. It brought me to tears and I stopped the movie, rewound it, and I also wrote it down for future monologues to audition with because it is perfect.
Yeah, it's just such a good scene, and it's so real. And he's talking and he's like, you just remember being a kid and doing things that you didn't understand why you did them.
Yeah,
and also like, that sort of like, you're with your parents at all times and you like almost resent your parents because they're your parents until you realize how special your parents are and how important they are. And he's having that moment as he really is having the realization that I probably won't ever get to see my mom again.
And he also has like that small moment of regret, but it's like such a childish regret when he's talking about how I would just pretend I was asleep.
I don't know why I did that. Yeah.
And it's just enough to where you're like, God, I've done things like there's things like that I hold on to, but in that moment, with that much gravity, realizing that your life is about to end,
yeah,
it's just perfect.
I wanted to use it as my line, thesis, and fist pump, but yeah. I used it as my thesis. And the reason I say that is that if you go look at the rest of Ribisi's career, you know, it's a tall order to be a young GI in this movie at this time. And actually watch your career as sort of a rising star for the next few years, because inevitably You have to ascend to mega stardom to ever live up to being in a better movie than this.
Mm-hmm.
Even the guys that continued to do good work, it's like this is still top build on their IMDb, because you have to be the Matt Damon if you really want to be the guy that is remembered for something more. And unfortunately for Ribisi, as his career went, he did do good work.
Oh, he does fantastic work.
You know, his next few years, like the role in the next few years that I remember the most,
is gone.
Is gone in 60 Seconds. I mean, that's just the one that we watched as kids. Mm-hmm. Like, he was a big role. He was like not the second lead, but he was an important character.
Definitely, and he's just great in it. He kind of has that, like, he's about to lose it all the time, you know?
Yeah, he was definitely pegged for a few years there as, like, that guy. Mm-hmm. He was going to be one of those up-and-comers.
It's like him... Oh, sorry. Yeah.
He kind of went dark in the mid-2000s there a little bit. And he's come back now, but it's as much more of, like, a... Giovanni Ribisi is still around. He's still doing character work, and we're still willing to watch because we like him.
Yeah, he was just in Ted. He was hilarious in it.
Yeah, but it's not the same thing as, like, this movie and the movies in the few years following where you're like, oh, he's the next sort of, like... He's that next heartthrob young character actor who could be... He's going to be, like, the second lead, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's... So, anyway, this scene defines him. It's the most memorable moment of his entire career, and to me, it's the defining moment of the movie.
I think that's a really interesting thesis. I want to say this really quick, though, to Jay Poke 23. He says, this movie is so accurate that as a combat vet, I can't even watch it anymore. So, thank you for watching the episode.
Thank you for your service.
And, I really do think that is a fantastic moment, but I actually disagree saying it's the most important part of the film. I actually think it's the scene with Steamboat Willie and Upham and Hanks revealing who he is and them letting him go and Sizemore and Burns exploding. And I think the reason why I believe that is because so much of this film is based on how many people are you willing to sacrifice to save one? And they talk about like you know, 30 people died to save one general or something at some point later on. And I just think it's so interesting because Upham is sitting there fighting to save Steamboat Willie's life.
Yeah.
Just the same way that all these guys are fighting to save Matt Damon's life. And you go and you fast forward to the end of the movie and you look at what Damon says. And at the very end, he goes, you know, I've tried to do that. You know,
like, yeah,
I've
right.
tried to live my life. And that's great. But then you look at Steamboat Willie, and he was saved by Upham. And what did he do?
Yeah.
You know, so I just think that that scene has so much juxtaposition of what's going on. And you see it from the other side. And, like, again, like, I keep thinking about life because a lot of the talk about it's just survival.
Yeah.
That dude's just surviving. He's just a German in war soldier trying to survive.
Yeah.
He's not an evil person. He's just doing what you would do. So,
right.
like...
Well, he... I mean, who knows if he's evil, but yeah. In the context of the story,
in the context
you're
of the film, he's not evil.
He's fighting for the other side.
He's just fighting for the other side, doing what you should do as a soldier.
Yeah.
So I just think that next scene is just that. It's crazy to me, but I love yours as well. So my thesis for this film, out of the seven of them, which a few of them are like, Upham's the biggest bitch in film history ever.
Yeah, right.
Edward Burns is the true hero of this film.
Yeah. tough to defend.
It's a tough one. But I think what my fist pump is that this film has the saddest deaths of any film ever.
Ugh, heartbreaking. Heartbreaking deaths.
Absolutely heartbreaking. Like, if you want to go from the least sad to the most sad, we can start with Vin Diesel.
Yeah.
Just trying to help a little girl out.
Pretty sad death,
shot,
too.
Struggling, dying out in the street slowly, and he holds up the letter for his dad. Like,
yeah.
That's the first one.
Yeah.
You know? And then you go on to, like, Sizemore's, you know, he's just a badass. Ah, it knocked the wind out of me. You know, but then Hanks looks over and you see him, and you see Hanks, you know, and his getting shot by Steamboat Willie. These all are sad.
Yeah.
Giovanni Ribisi's death
is
heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking.
Like, screaming out for mama, asking how big the wound is. Like,
yeah.
I wrote down the dialogue for it because it's just like, you know, how big's the hole? How's it look?
Yeah.
Put my legs up. And then at some point after that, he's like, he shot me.
Yeah.
And then you know, he asks, how big is the hole? And then he's like, I want to go home. And then Hank's like, what can we do? He's like, I just want a little more morphine.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the Goldberg death is, I can't even watch it.
Yeah.
I can't, because it's just, it just speaks so many volumes, getting murdered by the Hitler Youth knife, by that guy. That death is, I think, I like watching Requiem for a Dream. I like the last 30 minutes of Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
I cannot watch Adam Goldberg's death in this movie.
Yeah, it's so sad as Upham's on the stairs.
Right there, and he's the private that they're all rolling on top of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just can't.
Yeah.
Can't even, man.
It's brutal, man. No question. Guys, if you want to share your thesis statements, we will shout them out. Anybody in here that wants to share that. So moving on to the next part of the show, guys, we're getting into fist pump moment. It's weird to talk about fist pump moment in a movie like this.
It's a very different type of fist pump.
Yeah, and I tried to think about a lot of the different ones. Fist pump moment, guys, if you're watching or listening for the very first time, is that moment in a movie where something happens and you just kind of look around and you're like, God, this is so fucking sweet. I get to watch the rest of this movie right now. This is so awesome. God, I love this movie. And there's definitely a lot of those moments because this movie's great. It's a great, great, great movie. You know, the one that I went with is such a small moment. I would go with the Ribisi scene in the church.
Yeah.
Because the Ribisi scene in the church definitely is the moment that sticks with me the most in this movie.
Yeah.
And it is the definition of a fist pump because it brings you to tears. And it's not even bringing you to tears like in a Goldberg dying way. It's bringing you to tears like in a, this is like a really emotional part of the movie way.
Yeah.
That I relate to. But actually, I went something which is like much smaller. And it's just that he puts the crew together and there's that scene where they're coming over the hill. They're backlit and they're almost like silhouetted.
Mm-hmm.
It's right when they're first walking in the fields before they all start talking, and you see them come over the hill, and it's just like almost like a slow-mo silhouette of them coming over the hill, and I think you see the green of the grass and they're just black silhouettes. And it's just a great shot.
Yeah.
It's a great moment of composition for Spielberg. It's him understanding visuals. And Spielberg, by the way, Spielberg's one of the great masters. His importance to our generation is much more important to, he's even more important to the older generation, and the generation younger than us, I think, doesn't quite get it, because unfortunately the last 10 years of Spielberg movies have been overall pretty underwhelming.
Yeah, they really have been. And when you and I had that last week, if you guys want, you can go check out our Terminator episode. The two most iconic directors of our generation are probably Cameron and Spielberg, and the reason that you can argue that we argue that Cameron is more timeless is because of the last decade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His movies, he's made less movies, they've stood the test of time more. So, but there is that great, great eye for composition there, and I think Spielberg did get that, and I love that moment. So that's my fist pump. Just a real simple moment.
And it's such it feels so appropriate for this film. I'm just going to read a few out that we have in chat here. Richard Jarvie says his favorite is when Barry Pepper's up in the sniper tower quoting and shooting it. It's awesome. Another one are the ending when the plane flies by. You know, when I was a kid, I thought that Tom Hanks shot a bullet down the barrel and it blew up the tank. I told my friend about it. He's like, that's not what happened. You know, the planes flew up. I just was like, oh, right.
So I seem to remember having a similar conversation.
I was like 10,
You watched this when you were 10?
I watched it. Yeah, I watched it with my mom and her boyfriend at the time. And I remember my mom like looking over at him being like, I don't think he should watch this. And me being like, I have to watch this. And she was like, not happy.
I don't think I watched this for a few years.
Yeah, I watched it like right away. So my fist pump, I think, is just Sizemore at the end. His whole death sequence is incredible. So like all the way to when he gets like out of ammo, throw the helmet. Yeah. And he shoots the guy like, God, fuck you. You know, he's walking around. He gets the wind knocked out of him. Yeah. And he says that. It's just, he's just a badass.
He's
and like
great.
To think about what Sizemore was going through while filming this.
Yeah.
That was like one of the few moments where you kind of got to like chuckle and enjoy the movie for a minute.
Yeah.
So I remember that happened. I was just like, yeah, that's what I'd do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big shout out to you just read his Jarvie.
Richard Jarvie?
Richard Jarvie, sorry. Had a control of brain fart. Big shout out to Richard Jarvie. Thank you so much, by the way. I've been doing this show on Anchor every single day called Fist Pump Film Club, and he called in, and he's counting his 50 down with me.
Oh, so he said something about that in the chat, saying that it was like brutal or horrifying.
Horrifying.
But I think he's done.
So I'm counting my top 50 down. I've done 50 and 49. Yesterday I shared number 49 on my list, Just Friends, and Richard Jarvie shared his, which was A Good Year, the Russell Crowe, Ridley Scott movie from 03-04.
I've never seen.
Which I've never seen either. So thanks. And his number 50 was The Gray, which is sweet.
Oh, that's sweet.
It's a good 1-2 punch. So anybody who wants to get in on that, download Anchor. It's an awesome app. Find my station, Fist Pump Film Club, and share your thoughts. You can call in. I'll share your call-ins. It's kind of like Twitter meets podcasting. It's short-form audio blurbs.
I'm just going to throw this in real quick because I know you've seen The Thin Red Line. A few people are talking about it in the chat.
Yeah.
How do you feel in comparison for the two?
Thin Red Line versus Saving Private Ryan, I will always say Saving Private Ryan is a true, great, epic film. The script is perfect. The story is great. It does everything right. It's like a Spielberg doing exactly what Spielberg does best.
Mm-hmm.
The Red Line's a Terrence Malick movie. Those are very different films.
They get a little long-winded sometimes.
And Terrence Malick is a master of tone. He like likes to basically put photographs, like long photographs with beautiful music.
Right.
And there are these like that's like a philosopher's film, like disguised as a war film. When you watch Thin Red Line, it's nothing like this. It's really a completely different movie. I love Thin Red Line. It's just that it doesn't feel anything like this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've seen it a couple times, and I definitely feel like they're just indifferent. This movie you can argue is an action drama if you really want to. The Thin Red Line, you can't.
Yeah.
It's just a drama.
Absolutely, yeah.
So moving on here to star profiles, we're going to look at where these guys were at in their career when they made this movie, and we're going to start with Tom Sizemore. Sizemore was battling a drug addiction during production, and Spielberg would tell him every single day he had to take a blood test. Every single morning before filming, he would have to take a blood test, and if ever one test was failed, no matter when they were in the movie, if they're on the last day of production, this is Steven Spielberg, he would fire him and replace him.
Yep,
no matter
everything.
What, and reshoot the entire movie. Now, if he would have actually done that or not, I don't know if it was the last day of film, but it's Spielberg, so he could.
Yeah.
So what he had done, this is when Sizemore was peaking, I think. This is Devil in a Blue Dress, Heat, The Relic. He goes on to do Black Hawk Down. He turned down The Thin Red Line to be in this movie.
He's in, if I remember correctly, Natural Born Killers in 94.
Mm. Doesn't he have a cameo in Point Break?
Yeah, more than a cameo. Yeah. He's got like
a pretty good part, right?
Yeah.
So, and as you guys know, what's happened with Sizemore over the last half of his, I mean, the last part of his career is that that addiction and that battle took a toll on him, and
he kind of
fell out and faded away.
At the end of the episode, we are going to do a Where Are They Now segment about the entire platoon. So
this is like the biggest, like most stacked cast without knowing about it.
So we'll talk about kind of everybody where they're at now. But yes, I agree with you. I think Sizemore was peaking. This was his moment. He was just in a lot of good movies. He showed up in a lot of great stuff around then. And yeah, he really was that way for a few more years. So he's great. There was a lot of people up for the Sizemore role that were close to getting it.
Oh, yeah. The Billy Bob one was hilarious.
Yeah.
Billy Bob Thornton turned down the role because he couldn't film the first scene because he's horrified of water, which is like, Man, imagine being in that position where you have to turn down one of the greatest movies of all time because you have a phobia of water.
It's crazy.
Billy Bob wasn't hurting for work or anything.
No, he did a lot of good work. I think he got Oscar nominations like in a couple of years there.
Yeah, Sling Blade.
Yeah, and I think he got nominated for something else right around there, I thought. But anyway, moving on to Tom Hanks, where Tom Hanks was at the time in his career. One of the interesting questions that we got on Twitter for the AMA question that I'll just throw in now is, and I wish I could have it in front of me. I don't have it written down. But the question was, is there an actor with a better decade than Tom Hanks' 90s? Let's go through the list. Let's go just quickly go through the list. So you've got Apollo.
He wins back-to-back Oscars.
You've got Gump, and you've got
Philadelphia
back-to-back.
Big is that 90s too?
Big
is that
80s. Late 80s. You've got in the 90s, you've got Gump, you've got Toy Story.
Mm-hmm.
You've got
That Thing You Do, Apollo 13.
That Thing. Apollo 13. You've got what's it called? She's Got Mail. Is like
You've Got Mail.
You've got
Meg Ryan.
She's got Mail.
You've got Sleepless in Seattle's late 80s, right?
No, they're both 90s.
Oh, that's early 90s.
Both of those are 90s movies.
That was so funny. It was both with Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks.
I feel like there's at least one other like super relevant 90s movie. I think Toy Story 2 is also in the 90s.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Or is it 2000? I can't remember. And I think there's another big one that we're forgetting. Big at Philadelphia, as big as early.
Forrest Gump.
Oh, well, point is.
Oh, is Green Mile 99? Yeah. I think the Green Mile is 99.
I don't know.
I just watched it. I'm pretty sure it's 99.
Anyway, the question is this the most iconic decade for an actor ever?
I don't know if there's an actor that's got a better 90s.
Who else would it be? Or a better decade? Who are some of the people we've talked about? Cruise.
It's different. Cruise's decades are distinctly defined.
Pitt in the 90s. It's pretty big. Fight Club, yeah. Seven.
That's the big ones. His 2000s, it spreads out.
Clooney? 2000s?
Yeah, I mean, let's start with back-to-back Oscars. There's like four times in history it's happened.
Right.
So you've already got that feather in your cap. That's like hard to compete with that. Then you add in the definitive Pixar movie. Mm-hmm. You're the star of the definitive Pixar movie.
Yep.
Throw in Best Picture 94, right?
Throw in, three more leading actor nods? One for Gump, one for this, one for...
Castaways 2000.
That's the one it is.
But I mean, Apollo 13, like, something like five Best Picture nominations of movies you're in. I mean, I don't know if there's a better one for anyone ever. Like...
It's... You're going to be really hard-pressed to find that, because that doesn't really happen for people, where they're just... Not even Daniel Day-Lewis does things like that. Not even Leo does things
like
that.
You have to work so much, but then on top of working so much, you have to just make hit after hit after hit after hit. And not even just financial hit after financial hit.
Someone goes, She's Got Mails from the other guys, right?
Which makes sense. Yes. That's what I said.
And then someone just said Ben went full retard on that one.
As you say, because that's the line in Other Guys, when he's like, the movie where Tom Hanks gets poison ivy up his ass? She's Got Mail. Yes, She's Got Mail. It's wrong.
It's interesting because Jonas Tiger here says that Gump is highly overrated, in my opinion. It's funny because a lot of people do say that. A League of Their Own was another one. A lot of people do say that, but I completely disagree with that.
Gump's great.
He is that person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about our collective. No, this is not our collective. Let's talk about our top three Tom Hanks movies.
Right. Oh, so just real quick, just to give you the rundown, Apollo 13, 95, Toy Story, 95, and That Thing You Do in 96 were the three that he did leading up to this film.
Yeah. And big, friend of the show, That Thing You Do, John Sheck.
Yeah, John Sheck, our boy.
He came on for Collateral recently.
He did. So if you guys want to check that out, he was the lead in that film.
Yeah.
And he's a really nice guy.
Yeah. And if you, I actually also did an interview with him for I Talk Movies just right before that.
It's a cool interview.
Which is a lot of fun. He tells a lot of great stories. He was a good friend of Bill Paxton. This was shortly before Paxton passed. It's a really fun interview. You can find that here on the Popcorn Talk. More than that, though, guys, let's talk about...
Adam Sandler with the 90s is a good point, but there were still bad movies in there. Let's
definitely
keep going. Yeah.
So let's talk about top three Hanks.
Yeah, are they ranked? It's just top three.
I think it's top three.
Okay.
It's a very difficult list.
Without Saving Private Ryan, right?
SPR's off the tip.
Okay. So then I go Toy Story.
I match that.
As your three?
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, it's one of the greatest of all time. It is probably his most iconic voice, definitely.
Career-defining role would be an interesting conversation here. But
it's tough because he has so many. I think Forrest Gump really is, but then Toy Story is so much more successful.
Massive.
My next one is Castaway.
I've seen it once ever.
I honestly have only seen it a couple times up until this year. And it's on cable all the time. We have HBO, and I just watch it. I will always say this. I really think it speaks volumes about an actor when you can watch them on screen alone for like hours.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Tom Hardy did it in Lock. It wasn't that good. Ryan Reynolds did it in Buried. It was okay. Daniel Day-Lewis does it in the beginning of There Will Be Blood and it's successful.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to do. Matt Damon does it well on The Martian, right?
He's really good.
And Sam Rockwell does it well on Moon, but he has a robot to interact with. So
somebody just called into my station, by the way, and talked about Buried. Somebody, was it Jay Clymer Hammett? Somebody called in and was saying that they really, really enjoyed Buried. They thought it was a highly underrated movie. I said Just Friends is Reynolds' best movie next to Deadpool, and they said Buried is the movie you should watch.
I could totally agree with that because I really wanted to see Buried, and I just didn't.
Yeah.
So, anyway, yeah, that was my second.
I will go Road to Perdition as my second film.
I love that movie.
More than Road to Perdition, I love the soundtrack to Road to Perdition. Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable. This was the last great film Paul Newman was in before he passed.
Yeah.
This is Hanks in his tail end of his real prime. Jude Law in an important role as the assassin. It's really, really, really good. It's based on a comic book. It's like kind of a cross-country gangster movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hanks protecting his son. Again, it's another movie I've seen one time. I've listened to the soundtrack a lot more times. I just remember it really sticking with me, and loved this
good,
movie.
It's good, man. And Jude Law's creepy as hell in it. It's just a good movie.
Yeah, both Spielberg and Hanks' rankings are very hard because there's like 10 movies that I could put as movies that like I really like to love that movie.
Yeah.
But like, I want to talk about something a little more interesting. So, like, Road to Perdition jumps in for me because I just always remember feeling good about that movie.
Then your number one has got to be Catch Me If You Can.
It is. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. Which is good because someone just mentioned that in the chat. That is your favorite, right?
It's my favorite Tom Hanks movie. It's so weird. Making this top 50 list, guys, I've now mentioned a couple times, I had to really go through the list, right? I had to think about, okay, what's every movie I've ever watched that I've really liked? And then I had to start thinking, I started to look at, like, actors who I really love and look at their filmographies and saying, like, is there a movie in here that I like more? And what I've come across with Catch Me If You Can is that, okay, Hanks and Leo.
Oh, really quick, just bigger boat movies. Eddie is the guy that called in and said that.
Okay,
it was not Joel Hammond.
I shouted you out yesterday, Eddie, and thank you so much. I was listening to him as I was driving, and I missed on that. So thank you for correcting me on that. But yeah, bigger boat movies, actually, Eddie posted on Anchor. You can check out his station there as well.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, thank you so much for doing that. It's been so much fun interacting with you guys there. A couple of you called in and were like, I found you from AMA, and that's just been really cool.
Which I think is great because I think our fans are just telling us they want us to be doing more content, which you guys are going to be getting what you want relatively soon.
There's a big, big announcement coming pretty soon here. You guys are going to be real excited about
making moves.
So yeah, it's just Catch Me If You Can. Leo and Hanks. Leo, Hanks, Spielberg.
Yeah.
That's like, right there, you're like, well, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you go and watch this movie, it feels like watching Shawshank in the sense that, like, I can never turn it off when it comes on TV.
Yeah.
Ever. It's like, it's so appealing. It's like, Leo, it's the youngest version of Leo being the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah, and that movie, it's like, there's something hypnotic about that film, and I think it's the way, the pacing of it.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. That movie's an anomaly to me. It's probably my fourth or fifth.
Yeah.
It's just so good.
I just love it. It's like, I think it's the only Hanks movie that made my top 50. I think it's like number 41 or 42. It's
and
right
in
there.
That scene at the end.
It's so...
The battle of wits between the two of them, both just lying out their fucking teeth.
It's so good. And his scenes with... What walking?
Oh yeah, every scene that they're heartbreaking.
They're so good.
They're so good.
This movie, that movie is so good. I'm obsessed with that movie.
Yeah, and my number one's Forrest Gump.
Okay, you
and
wanted,
I and
yeah.
I know that a lot of people argue about that, but look, it's one of the greatest stories ever told in film, and that role is incredible. There's not moments where you fall out of it, where you don't believe it. He's completely believable as Forrest Gump, and that monologue that he delivers to Jenny's grave at the end of the movie
yeah.
is one of the most heartbreaking, just beautiful things ever in film.
Yeah, it was, you left, right?
Yeah, I miss you, Jenny.
Oh, it's so good.
God, every time when he says that, I cry. So that is my number one Hanks.
You know, I have an interesting game to play here. We've only done this once before on the show, but I kind of think it's fitting because of who he is.
God damn it.
I think we should do it. I think we should play the movie game on Hanks.
All right.
Marissa, can we get a timer up on screen? Is that possible? By the way, guys, if this is interesting to you, it should be, because Andrew and I won our very first ever match on the Schmodown, and a lot of the points we got came in the Tom Hanks category, which our opponents got, and they bombed on the Knight Sisters, Emma Fife and Joel Monique, good friends of ours. They just like missed a bunch of questions, and we stole all of them.
Yeah.
We got like, we only missed one steal, but we did better on their category than they did. It was like a pretty remarkable... Oh, yeah, you're writing some movies.
Look, man, I can't do this. I'm freaking out, okay?
So, guys, the way this works is Andrew and I will each have... let's get like a 20-second timer. I think that's fair, because it'll only go to 20 probably towards the last round, so Andrew inevitably runs out and loses. So we're going to go back and forth naming movies that Tom Hanks has been until one of us gets stumped, and that will be the winner. If you can, I don't know if there's any way for you to play along. Maybe if you're watching or listening and this is not live, if it isn't streaming, pause, take yourself 5 minutes, see how many you can write down, see how well you do. He's been in a lot of movies. So I'm gonna go ahead and just say, ready to roll?
Look, man, I'm getting there.
All right, I'm gonna start.
All right, go ahead.
Toy Story.
Toy Story 2.
Toy Story 3.
I give up. Saving Private Ryan.
All right, I'm gonna say Forrest Gump.
I will say...
Five.
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, okay, I'm gonna say Catch Me If You Can.
I'll say Big.
Okay, I'm gonna go ahead and say Castaway.
I'll say Sleepless in Seattle.
I'm going to say She's Got Mail.
That's not a real movie, Ben. You lose.
Oh, the timer's supposed to be for... wow, we did all that in 20 seconds. For if one of us gets stumped. So we'll hit that timer in the later rounds. Actually, we're probably good without the timer, Marissa. I was wrong about that. I appreciate it. Marissa Serafini's in the booth, by the way, everybody. We were so excited that we missed it and we didn't introduce her. Marissa, how you doing today?
Hey, Marissa.
Hi, boys. How are you?
Good.
Excellent.
Just hanging out.
So you went Sleepless in Seattle?
And you went She's Got Mail, which is not a movie.
I went She's Got Mail.
I will go Joe versus the Volcanoes.
Oh.
Volcano.
It's just a singular.
It's seven volcanoes, actually.
I'm going to say Da Vinci Code.
Then I'll say Angels versus Demons.
And it's Angels and Demons.
I said Angels and Demons.
I'm going to say Inferno.
That movie's not a real movie. I'll say Lady Killers.
Ooh, okay. I'm going to say The Terminal. He's been in so many movies.
Apollo 13.
Okay. We already did Big. You'll say Apollo 13. Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and throw in The Polar Express.
I will do That Thing You Do, then.
Okay, you're going to go That Thing. So then I'm going to go The Circle. It comes out this weekend.
You can't do that. It's not out yet.
Okay.
It's a rule.
You're so
it's a goddamn
you're
rule,
so
Ben.
You're so angry. I'll
that
go,
timer's ticking.
I'll go Dragnet.
Shit. Devil in a Blue Dress?
Not in it.
Not in that. Ah, damn it. Cars.
He's
he
in
is
Cars?
The Woody car in Cars.
Okay, so we'll go Cars 2.
He's not in Cars 2.
He's not in Cars 2?
No, he's not.
You're positive about that?
I'm positive.
Okay, fine. Turner
Three.
And Hooch.
Two.
Turner and Hooch.
I don't know. I give up.
The Man with One Red Shoe. The Burbs.
I just don't want to keep wasting
punchline,
time on this.
The Money Pit.
Ah!
All right, moving on.
It's funny that you've brought that game up without telling me twice in a row on this show. It's interesting how that happens, isn't
interesting.
It?
Interesting.
I'm going to start bringing up games on my own, too, Ben.
She's Got Mail.
How many words can you say in Korean? Go.
I lose.
I win!
Kimchi? Right.
What's next?
Is that a word? Korean? All right. Moving on.
Captain Phillips. Bridge of Spies. All right. So moving on to production development. I hate you. So a couple things that are interesting about this. This is the last film that was edited on a non-digital editing system to win Best Editing in the Academy Awards. I just think that's cool because I can't even imagine how much film was
yeah.
on the floor in that room.
Especially how long the movie is. I wonder how much they cut out. You know, like a wonder.
If there was like a director's cut.
Yeah, probably. I wouldn't even know where to start.
This movie is written by Robert Rodot, if you want to take that, since I know you did the work on that.
Yeah, Robert Rodot. These are a lot of guys we've covered, actually, in the past. So Rodot, most famously, also wrote The Patriot.
I'm leaving. I realize that I'm pretty upset about this.
He also wrote The Patriot. That's the last time we covered him.
Favorite movie ever.
Yeah, it's a great film. He's a great writer. He worked on the revision of the script for 10,000 BC. He did some revisions on Thor, The Dark World. He did do a screenplay for Warcraft, but it was ultimately not used.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's worked with good people for a long time. And then he did create the show Falling Skies, which... That's like his big...
People love that show.
I've never watched it.
Yeah, I haven't watched it either.
Yeah, I interviewed one of the stars of it at one point, and it tracked. So I think people do like the show.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much Robert Rodot. There was a bunch of stuff in here about like people that he's worked with, and mm-hmm. apparently the draft of the script is based on an earlier story from another war. He had done some... Frank Darabont had done some uncredited rewrites on this script.
Right.
But one thing that I thought was super... Oh, yeah. A couple things. One...
The Damon story?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cool thing.
Yeah. Matt Damon improvised his little monologue at the end.
Yeah, he stole it from a book, The Gross, by Peter Bart, and...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and what you can tell when you're watching it is, like... That monologue might be one of the greatest moments in his career.
Yeah.
Honestly, because the way he sells it, and, like, he goes back to it, and then, like, how it is after when he... Then, you know, afterwards he can see his brother's faces.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, what's so cool about it is that the crew was watching it, and it's like rambling and not funny or interesting, but Spielberg loved it so much.
Yeah.
And no one else wanted to put it in the film, but Spielberg was like, no, that's going in the film. And it's perfect, because you're sitting there, and I think the best part about it is Hank's look on his face.
Right.
This is just some dumb kid from Iowa that doesn't... Why?
Yeah, he's
why
talking
him?
About like he's like his farm boy brothers and this ugly
it's
girl.
Like the story, and Hanks is kind of sitting there listening. Hanks is like, I got a family back home. I teach kids. I coach baseball.
People
I have a life. People have died to save you, and there's people waiting on me back home. You can't even remember what your brother looks like. Like, you know what I mean? So it's just something about that. But yeah, it's just a great monologue.
Yeah, it's really good. Something that I thought was really interesting as I was reading about this film, and I had a conversation with someone last week about this, but I think it's probably the three of their relationships to Tom Hanks that makes me feel like there's this relationship here.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever thought about the relationship between Frank Darabont, Robert Zemeckis, and Steven Spielberg in the 90s?
No, not really, but I like when you go back and you do the math and you think about all the movies that they did.
Like, so last week we talked about Zemeckis, because I was blown away when I looked at how many movies he had made, right? Zemeckis and Spielberg are, like, much more on par in terms of actual number. They've made a lot of classics between the two of them. Even things as simple as, like, Zemeckis directing all of the Back to the Futures, Spielberg directing all of the Indiana Joneses.
Right.
There's a lot of that sort of crossover of very notable movies. And then Darabont, obviously, is most famous for having done both Shawshank and Green Mile.
Yeah.
But if you think about the 90s, like, Tom Hanks worked with Darabont on Green Mile. He worked with Darabont on, or he worked with Zemeckis on Forrest Gump. He worked with Spielberg on what's it called? This movie, Saving Private Ryan. And he worked with Zemeckis again on Castaway in 2000.
Right.
It's like he worked with those three guys repeatedly. He went back to Spielberg like four or five more times.
Which is funny, because Spielberg doesn't really work with a lot of people usually. He likes to just work on his own.
Yeah, yeah. I just think it's like so interesting. It's like, did those three guys benefit from the greatness of Tom Hanks, or did Tom Hanks benefit from the greatness of these three guys?
Both? I think it's both for sure. Yeah. I really do, because I think no matter what you say about Tom Hanks, that dude does a great job, you know, in everything he does. Even if the movie's not good, he's still believable.
Always.
Always. No matter what. And that's really all that you're asked to do as an actor. I don't care what you say. All that you're supposed to do is tell a story honestly. Really.
You said earlier, maybe we were on or off camera, that Tom Hanks is the greatest everyman in film.
Yeah, I think so.
Who would be the second?
Harrison Ford, maybe?
Probably, right.
I think so, because he's like...
He lost his wife a lot of times.
He lost his wife a lot of times and his kids. He's been in comedies. He's done everything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, they both...
And neither of them were ever, like, jacked or shredded or superheroes, you know what I mean? Like, even Ford as Indy wasn't ever, like...
Denzel's a pretty great everyman.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, he's more...
He's a noble savage.
Yes. He feels more movie starry.
He does.
Than those guys?
The thing about their delivery, too, I think Hanks is the best at it.
Yeah.
There's no movie stardom behind his delivery.
No.
It's just a man. Whereas Denzel could say anything, and you're like, cool.
Hanks has the movie star charisma, though. He's got the charm, you know?
Yeah.
Hanks has, like... Yeah, yeah, yeah. He has the all... Sort of like the all-time charm.
Yeah, I mean, and you got to remember that, like... In the 90s, Tom was the everyman guy you fell in love with. Sleep in Seattle and She's Got Mail.
She's Got Mail. I can't remember what it was, but there was something like an article I read once that was like a role that would normally only go to the Toms. It was like written in the early 2000s.
Uh-huh.
And it really made you realize that like in the 90s, Tom and Tom were king. They were...
Yeah, absolutely.
They were the two people that if you were going to have a franchise movie, you could base it around Tom Hanks if you wanted it to be relatable, mm-hmm. or Tom Cruise if you wanted it to be an action movie.
Or Will Smith if you wanted to be a comedy. Action comedy.
If you wanted it to go down 20 years later as a comedy.
Exactly.
I think that's super, super interesting. But anyway, I was trying to like pivot back to another point that I completely forgot about. We'll continue moving down the line. So Spielberg, what's there to fucking say?
Right. Like, if you don't know who Steven Spielberg is, then just remember Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Indiana Jones, AI. He's won several Best Directors and Best Pictures, Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan. All of the indie films, E.T., Jurassic Park, Jaws, $8.5 billion at the box office. What else is there to talk about?
Like, this is the difference. James Cameron's made, like, seven movies. Steven Spielberg has made seven bad movies since making, like, 10 of the most classic movies ever made. Like, take his seven last movies out of the picture, and he still has E.T., Jaws, Close Encounters, Forrest Gump, not Forrest Gump, Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List,
all the indies,
Amistad, all the indies. He's got like 12 classics minus his, you know, and it's not...
It's funny we never even talked about War of the Worlds on this episode yet.
Yeah, or the fact that Lincoln got like a 13 Oscar nominations and we're all just like, yeah, that movie didn't happen.
Yeah, it didn't.
What the fuck is with Lincoln?
I don't know, and it bothers me.
I don't
get it. We lost a trivia show because we couldn't figure out a movie where someone had won Best Actor in a or Best Picture in a whatever film, and like, I love Daniel Day-Lewis, and it's just, what
it's like
is with that movie? It's The Great White Buffalo.
It's like we're colorblind to Lincoln. I don't get it. It's like something about that movie, we forget that it exists. You'll notice that on the game we played, neither of us mentioned Lincoln. It came out 4 years ago and got 13 nominations or something.
With one of my favorite actors of all time. With one of the greatest directors of all time.
I think collectively our favorite actor of all time.
Yeah.
I mean, Swayze is my favorite, but in terms of acting ability, there's no one.
It makes no sense.
You've not seen it, right?
I've not even wanted to see it.
Nor have I.
Anyway,
bizarre.
That's a weird thing with Steven Spielberg.
So anyway, Spielberg, though, as well as directing this film, also produced this film with a group of guys, Ian Bryce, Mark Gordon, Gary Levinson. So all of these are guys we've talked about in the past, actually. Mm-hmm. Levinson and Gordon are two of the major producers on here. They worked with Roland Emmerich a whole bunch, so Day After Tomorrow, 2012, or some of the movies they've worked on. A lot of like 90s stuff, like The Jackal, Hard Rain.
Yes, The Jackal.
Ian Bryce has worked on a ton of different stuff, going all the way back to our second or third episode that we ever worked on, Speed. He produced Speed. So, but also like a huge, huge list of stuff.
All the Transformers.
Yeah. 1985's Ewoks, The Battle for Endor.
World War Z.
Yeah, big movies. You know they're making a World War Z sequel?
World War Z.
What?
Like that? World War Z? Schmodown? World War Z, huh?
Oh, is that one of our ones that we got right?
Let's just say it was on the show.
Yes. So anyway, that's pretty much the group. Spielberg, though, interestingly enough, has over 150 producing credits.
Yeah, he's produced more than he's directed, and again, the money is just insane.
Astounding. Yeah, we can throw up his box office here in a second. We'll talk about it in a minute. So before we move on from Spielberg, a couple things. One, I think we want to do a collective top five on Spielberg. I think that seems like a good idea, considering all of the movies we've just been rattling off.
Yeah. I think you do a collective top five. And guys, if you want to do a top five with us, please put it in the chat or at AMA Podcast. Let us know. We're going to try to zip through this. Fifth for us, these aren't entirely ranked, but we'll just say the first one we're mentioning is the indie series.
Yeah, I think there's varying opinions.
It's funny because a lot of people say Raiders of the Lost Ark is the best.
Henry.
God damn it. And then you like Last Crusade.
Last Crusade's the one that I watched growing up.
I think I've only seen it a couple times. Temple of Doom is the one I watched growing up.
The Ball, right?
The Ball. Or what do you mean?
Or is the Ball in Raiders?
The Ball's in Raiders, yeah. No, it's in Temple, but that's also the monkey brains and the heart.
He tears it out of his chest.
Just awesome. So, yeah, indie movies, and I think if you ignore those, we'd get crucified.
Yeah, except for Crystal Skulls, because that's bad.
Yeah,
and there's a fifth one coming out with Chris Pratt in the lead, right? Isn't that the deal?
Yeah.
So, the indie movies, number... We can throw it in again, just because I know we've already talked about it. Catch Me If You Can, we can collectively say, is not necessarily number four, but is on the list. I think we both like that movie. You mentioned earlier it was probably top four or five for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I love Catch Me If You Can. Minority Report?
Yeah, definitely. We've covered that
absolutely.
On the show
absolutely. I have learned to love that movie more and more every time I watch it. It's always on cable again. That is maybe... No. Let's keep going. I don't want to say anything crazy.
Quick thought. Well, remind me to come back to this because I have a point that I want to make about Minority Report. Mm-hmm. I would say probably number two for us or on the list is Jurassic Park.
Oh, definitely Jurassic Park.
The Lost World.
Obviously.
No, just Jurassic Park.
That's one with William H. Macy.
I think he's in three for some reason.
Oh, is Lost World the second one?
Second one's the one with Vince Vaughn and Julianne Moore, is that right? And the third one's the one with William H. Macy and Laura Dern comes back, maybe?
Oh, God, I don't know. That series really went off the rails.
Went off the deep end. Yeah. Though the world seems to love Jurassic World, Roxy Stryer especially.
You and I hated that movie.
Yeah.
We were not fans.
We were not fans. Uh-uh. And there's another one of those coming out.
Yes, there is.
And then number one is Schindler's List, which,
It's just like this movie. It's the perfect depiction of something that you don't always want to know about or watch.
I think another one of the AMA questions that came up was, is this Spielberg's best movie? And the only movie, really, in my opinion, would be Schindler's List.
Yeah.
Schindler's List or Saving Private Ryan. I mean, there's the whole multitude of other movies we've mentioned all could be in the conversation. And somebody would say Jaws is his best movie. Somebody would say E.T. is his best movie. Mm-hmm. You can make the arguments. But in terms of actual longevity in movies that will last, that people want to watch over and over again, those are the two.
Those are two films that are absolutely and will always be unequivocally timeless. All the other movies that he does, they're going to age because there's special effects in them. E.T., all the indie movies, like, it's not that they're not good. Jaws is aged. Jaws is great, but it's aged. It's not scary anymore. It's nostalgic.
Yeah.
But Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List, you could watch 50 years from now, they could have came out today, and they'd still, you would believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, Schindler's List, it's great. I haven't seen it in a long time.
It's really hard to watch. And yeah. And Ralph Fiennes is just the biggest piece of shit you've yeah. ever seen on camera. Incredible, though.
Who plays in The Pianist? Who plays the...
Adrian Brody.
No, but the Nazi, I mean.
The one that saves him?
Yeah.
I can't remember his name, but he's...
It's not, so I was thinking it was Ralph Fiennes.
No, it's not. He looks similar, but yeah, that guy's great.
Yeah. Awesome. I haven't seen The Pianist since it came out.
Also, just heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking, yeah. Right.
All right, so movie... Oh, sorry.
So the thing I wanted to point out, though, so this is something I thought about, and I thought a lot about this with Spielberg, because I feel like you'll agree with me on this. The defining characteristic of Spielberg movies is that he uses these little moments to punctuate his scenes, and they don't matter to the story. Like, so a great example of this is in Saving Private Ryan, when they're in the trenches, and that guy takes a bullet to the helmet, and Hanks is like, lucky son of a bitch, and then he gets shot in the head.
Yeah.
It's like set up, punchline.
Yep.
You know, and it's the same thing. It's like Minority Report, where it's like they're flying around with the jetpacks, and it's like the guy in the jetpack, they go through the floor, and there's the kid practicing saxophone, and he's like looking at them, and you're like, it doesn't matter to the story.
Oh, right.
But Spielberg adds stuff like that because it's like, it's these sort of little, like, he wants to punctuate his scenes with these, like, memorable moments that don't actually matter.
Yeah.
That guy taking the bullet in the head doesn't matter. We'd seen six Mm-mm. guys next to Hanks get taken out. Like, it's totally irrelevant.
Yeah, you got the guy walking, holding his own arm on the beach. You got the guy that drowns, that doesn't even make it to the beach. He doesn't even get shot.
Yeah.
He just falls off the damn boat and drowns.
Yeah.
Like, small things like that, that it just creates a world.
It's just so interesting, these, like, little moments. I was thinking about that more and more. It's like, I think it's one of his big things as a director that he does, is he sees the opportunity. Let's just throw in that little yeah. that cute moment for a second.
Like when the daughter gets given back to her father.
Yeah.
You could have just cut the scene of her running back up, but he lets it go on along a little bit longer, and the dad apologizes, and the girl's like yelling and hitting him
slapping
in the face.
Him.
Like, and it's just cute, and it's like endearing a little bit.
Yeah. It's like the portrait that he paints or something is that much more rich because he throws in those little moments.
Yeah. By the way, you guys are talking about In Bruges with Ralph Fiennes in there. In Bruges is one of my favorite
great,
movies. He's
great.
Amazing in that movie.
Who steals the movie, though? Brendan Gleeson.
It's Brendan Gleeson with his RAR. What was I going to say? Oh, another part of this movie was just a really quick shot that does speak volumes. Well, there's Tom Sizemore gathering the dirt, which is just cool.
Yeah,
it's just a small thing. But it's at the very end when Hanks's hand stops shaking.
Yeah.
That's a shot you have to have.
Right.
But it was just so subtle. And then you were like reminded, like, oh, wow, he's finally at peace.
He's finally at peace.
Yeah.
Before we get into critical and box office, question for you. One thought that I had while watching this movie was, looking back on it today, how important are the bookends?
That's such an interesting question. I think they're irrelevant.
I found myself thinking, definitely at the beginning it seemed irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Definitely at the beginning it felt like, this feels like the beginning of The Rock. I don't need this.
It totally did.
Yeah. The end, it was like it made...
I miss you so much.
A little more sense. But even in the end, I was like... He asks her if he's lived a good life, and he says, I've tried to do what you said. We don't know if he's lived a good life. It almost doesn't matter if he's lived a good life, and it's
doesn't.
Almost... It's,
and
it Hollywood's
takes away
it.
From it. It does. And
because he's just a kid.
He's just a kid, and also, you're taking away the last line of the movie from Tom Hanks. You're taking away the earn it from him.
Yeah.
That's the best part of their relationship. That's the whole before and after is all in tribute to that line.
Yeah.
You don't need... It's like an improv when you pull out a gun and you say, I've got a gun.
Right. Yeah.
I don't need you to do that. I can see you got a gun.
Indicating.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think, like, the more I thought about it, the more I was just like, that feels like the one misstep, the one unnecessary moment in the movie.
It really does. It's so weird.
It's the same thing as... It's actually the same thing as Green Mile. All that shit, the cutback stuff, feels like when you watch it, you're like, I mean, I get where the short story had to go somewhere. You
right.
couldn't just tell this story and have it be this long. But all the stuff about supernatural and living forever, it's like, this is just not good.
Extra.
It adds the movie in a way it doesn't.
That movie aged pretty poorly.
Yeah, I just watched it for the first time last week, and I was kind of like, man, this is not very good.
That's one of the ones you'd have to have watched when it came out to appreciate it now, I think, is, you know. All right, so moving on to critical and box office, this is going to be very interesting to talk about because this movie was incredibly successful.
Yeah.
DreamWorks produced this movie for only $70 million. I think that might be what blew my mind more than anything in this.
Yeah.
This movie only cost $70 million, and like $10 million of it or something was spent on the beach.
Yeah.
It was like, it took 4 weeks to film that Normandy day scene, and they would just move like inches up the beach and just shoot. So $70 million to produce it or to make it, and it opened July 24th in 1998. It grossed $216 domestic, an additional $265 worldwide for a grand total of $481 million. This is the first movie for DreamWorks to cross $100 million at the box office, and it opened at number one at $30 million.
So I pulled his top 20 adjusted. Rarely do we pull domestic adjusted. We usually pull worldwide all time.
Uh-huh.
The reason I did it is because he's been making blockbusters since the 70s, so it didn't feel fair to go with unadjusted. I felt like for movies like E.T. and Jaws, you had to pull the adjusted.
Right.
So if we can get that blown up a little bit, Marissa.
Yeah, you have to pull adjusted for someone that's been around for 30, 40 years.
And just start at the top and scroll down so we can see. It's pretty interesting. I would have thought this was higher. It ends up only looks like it's like 8th maybe? 1, 2, 3, 4,
Wait,
5.
Wait, what's second?
Or 10th. It looks like you got E.T. followed by, I think that's Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
They're over a billion after adjustment. Jurassic, Raiders of the Lost Park, Close Encounters, Temple of Doom.
Raiders of the Lost Park.
Lost World, She's Got Mail. No, just kidding. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Saving Private Ryan. SPR is number 10. You see that?
Yeah.
Number 10 after adjustment. A movie that made, in its time.
Yeah.
And this is just domestic, but in 1998 made $216 million.
A quarter of a billion dollars, essentially, in 88. But, yeah. I mean, you got to think E.T. and Jurassic Park and Jaws.
Because
like,
they're older, the inflation matters more.
Bigger, yeah.
Yeah, the statistic's a little weird. I don't really think that that's the most accurate statistic, but I thought that that was a pretty interesting list. I was a little surprised.
Other than the Crystal Skull, like, look at that list.
Yeah, it's crazy. No. Yeah, it's an insane list.
Perfect. So, critically, this movie has an 8.6. It's number 29 on the top 250. This is one of those times where I feel like you and I probably see pretty close to eye to eye on that and feel like it's pretty legitimate.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was so weird for me watching this after, like I said, putting Lone Survivor in my top 50 and then watching this movie. It's like,
right, right.
You know, it's like kind of a joke to even
compare
it's
them.
It's not a joke because Lone Survivor is highly underrated. That movie's really good. It's not. People think that movie is like all like America. It is and it's not. It's a really good movie. But this is like an all-time piece of cinema history.
This is a piece of art.
Yeah.
Like, literally.
But I still don't think I would replace it. I don't think this would go in my top 50.
You don't think this makes your top 50 for any of those movies?
It's just like...
That's crazy to me, man.
What I realized when I looked at the list, because I did the one fix I mentioned last week.
Which was?
I found room for Transformers the Animated Movie.
She's got Raiders of the Lost Park.
I kicked off Slumdog Millionaire.
What?
Yeah.
For what?
Transformers the Animated Movie.
Oh my god, dude. All right. I can't even listen to you right now.
Really? I love Slumdog. Huge fan.
Look, I know Transformers is great, but like...
But this is what I was just alluding to, though. This is what I was getting at. What I realized about the top 50 is that it has more to do with memories associated with numbers of times you've watched a movie. Like, for instance, if you made your top 50 movies of all time, I would not be shocked if Lethal Weapon 4 made your top 50.
It would not, but I could see why you would say that.
Because you might just run through your movies and be like,
I love that movie.
Right. I mean, for this, for instance.
Con Air would probably make my top 50.
And from a quality perspective, you know that you can think of 50 movies that you could say are higher quality.
I could literally list 50 movies right now that are better than that.
Even than The Patriot, but you would put The Patriot in your top 50.
Probably. Yeah. And Last Samurai.
Yeah, because... You watched them a shitload of times. You loved them.
They meant
something really, really special to you.
Yeah.
And even though you can think of better movies, it's like, yes, Slumdog's objectively a much better movie.
But, like, I would never be able to argue against movies like Shawshank and Saving Private Ryan and, you know what I mean? Like, those movies just have to be in there for me.
True. And Saving Private Ryan, that's like I said, I haven't watched this movie in over 10 years.
Right.
It's possible that this will sit with me more and more, and the more I think about it. But I wasn't compelled to go back and watch this movie.
You're so screwed with this list, man.
Yeah.
Especially because after a year, you're going to be able to put La La Land and Logan on it.
I know.
You have to bump off two more.
Hot Rod and Just Friends.
Right.
What a shame!
All right, so back to Critical. This movie got an 8.6, and it was number 29 of all time. It follows our algorithm with a 92% by all critics, 89% by top, and a 95% by audience. This movie was nominated for, I think, 11 Academy Awards. And it won 5. Director, cinematography, sound, editing, and effects in sound effects.
It's one of the all-time, how the hell did Shakespeare in Love beat this? It's like, that's like one of the all-time questions.
Which is so crazy, because I think Marissa might even be one of the people, but there's been a handful of people that I've said this about.
Rocha.
Was Rocha one of them?
He loved Shakespeare.
Rocha was one of them as well, yeah. Where they're like, I completely agree with that award. I think Shakespeare in Love should have won. Was that you, Marissa, or am I just making that up?
Yeah, it was both of us, Rocha and myself.
Unbelievable.
It's hard. So I haven't watched it since we had this conversation last time, so I still can't.
It's just like what this movie speaks to for American history and film history, it just seems impossible. But hindsight's 2020.
Spielberg won the Oscar for director. It's really difficult to argue when the director wins. Those examples where the movie, where the director wins one thing, but the, like, they don't add up.
It doesn't happen where you, yeah, anytime a movie gets 11 nods, like.
You go back to Crash, Brokeback. Crash is not as good as Brokeback. Ang Lee won for Brokeback, but for some reason they gave it to Crash. Didn't this year Moonlight beat La La Land, but Chazelle won, or did, was it they both direct, both awards went to Moonlight? Does anybody know that?
I think director went.
Damien won.
Yeah, Damien did win for La La. Exactly. Yes.
We both.
And the Moonlight wins Big Picture, even though La La, whatever. Yeah. Okay, so moving on. It was nominated for, on top of that, Picture, Leading Actor, Screenplay, Set Decoration, Makeup, and the Music/Score, which was by Murphy, I believe. So what's coming up next is our favorite line.
Favorite line, yeah. This is weird because so many of the favorite lines are tied into other things. We've mentioned a lot of them.
Have we talked about the scene in the church with Giovanni Ribisi?
it's hard, man. I really wouldn't know where to start with favorite line. Because I've already said the ones that were in my mind as my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Shit, man. I really don't know. I think our one line that I do really like is when they're all about to go take on that gunner. And he's like, "Who's going left? Who's going left?" And no one, and he's like, "I'll go left." And then, and then Sizemore's like, "Maybe I should go left." He's like, "Maybe you should shut up."
Yeah.
And I like that moment a lot. I like that line, and I like that moment because it's like, he's just like, "I'm the commanding officer, and I've said what I'm going to say, and you didn't offer in the first place. Why are you talking?
Yeah. Why? What are you doing?
Shut up."
Yes. Yeah. And I love the Burns and Sizemore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Burns is really good in this. Ed Burns
Everyone
is great.
Goldberg, Burns, Pepper. We're about to get into it. Everyone's perfect. And this is another one of those things I talk about. I say it in Requiem for a Dream, and I say it in Boogie Nights. I think if you have the right direction, anyone can be not anyone, but actors that are normally mediocre can be Oscar worthy.
Right. She's got mail.
She's got mail. Yeah. Definitely.
What's your favorite line?
My favorite line is it definitely feels a bit cliche. I mean, it's obviously the Ribisi speech, and then it's him dying. Those are great, but it's "Earn it." It's when Hank says, "Earn it." And the reason it's my favorite is because it feels cliche. It feels like it's what has to be said, right? He's about to die, and they saved him, and he sacrificed everything. But the amount of weight that is on that line and the delivery that he does, which is just what we talked about, there's no movie stardom behind it.
Yeah.
It's literally like, well, they were right.
Right.
Everyone's dead. All to save this one kid, and we don't know anything about him or if he deserves it or not.
And I also love that it happens right after, like, what is ultimately just such a Spielbergian scene of the tank moving towards him and him shooting at a tank with a handgun.
Yeah.
That's such a great, iconic, memorable moment in the movie, right? Like,
yeah, and it's like, for some reason, the guys in there can't actually hit Hanks on the ground. And it's just great.
It's great, yeah. I agree.
Yeah, earn it.
So let's get into Where Are They Now, guys? We have decided to revisit this entire character actor laden cast and discuss what happened to their careers and where they are now. We are running low on time, so we're just going to do a quick run through on each of these guys. I'll kind of sound off. You'll sound off. First and foremost, Tom Sizemore, rising star. This was definitely, as we mentioned, his peak. His next few years were big with, as you said, Black Hawk Down. Sizemore really in the mid-2000s just... his career floundered. He ran back into drug problems. Most notably recently, if you go to his IMDb page, legitimately 17 films announced in production or in post-production. He's clearly in, like, I'm just taking work mode.
Yeah, I need to get money.
Yeah. Because, man, there is a lot of stuff. I have not heard of one of them. I saw him in an indie movie called Atomica very recently that is fine. He's fine in it. Mm-hmm. And most notably in the last few years, he had a recurring role in Hawaii Five-0, and that's pretty much... Oh, and Shooter, the new Shooter show. He was in six episodes.
Right, right. I wanted to mention Damon real quick just because Spielberg cast Damon... based off of a recommendation from Robin Williams on set for Good Will Hunting, which I thought was cool because Spielberg thought that Damon was too young and too small to play a soldier. And
because he had seen him in, what, Courage Under Fire?
Courage Under Fire, yeah. And then, there was one more part of that. And then it was kind of a bummer because Damon became an overnight star with Good Will Hunting, and that was completely not planned.
And he wanted him to be the surprise guy that shows up.
Surprise guy that no one knew about.
Which is so funny going forward if you think about Interstellar, because he's the unnecessary surprise guy who shows up who isn't billed.
Totally true.
Yeah.
There was one more thing I wanted to say about Damon, but I can't remember.
I mean, Matt Damon is he's the only guy out of the entire cast that has truly become
a superstar.
Well, yeah. Diesel, definitely.
Diesel is too, but like not in the same way.
But different.
Damon. Yeah.
Damon's iconic as like, this is an actor who could be nominated or win an Oscar for any movie he's in, mm-hmm. but he also could lead an action franchise.
Right.
Whereas if you then jump over to Vin Diesel, this is really interesting. He had written and directed his debut Strays.
He was also the lead in that, yeah.
Yeah, which Spielberg saw and then cast him in this role. He got paid $100,000 with like no credits to do this movie. And then Diesel's career took off. You know, he's in the Fast and the Furious movies. He's like
Triple X, Pitch Black, yeah.
Yeah, he's in all those movies for the next few years, but then Diesel is, I think, so perplexing because he... Do you remember when Diesel, like, he left movies for a minute?
Yeah.
06.
Yeah, I think it's because the Fast franchise had kind of petered out and no one else wanted him anymore.
He made that movie Find Me Guilty in 06. So between, like, 06 and, like, 13, he makes, like, five movies in 8 years.
And a movie called A Man Apart as well.
Yeah, that's when he's still doing it. It's, like, 03, I think. And then he made like, the fourth Fast and the Furious. He came back. And then the fifth one... And then Diesel's brand really blew back up with that. Yeah, he was in Guardians absolutely. Of the Galaxy. He made another Triple X.
Now he's untouchable. Being part of Guardians and the Fast franchise, which you did not like the Fate of the Furious, right?
I was not a fan.
Yeah. One more thing I did want to say about Damon, which I thought was cool, is that he did not participate in any of the boot camp that everyone else did, and he did not have to go through any of the shit that the platoon did so that they would have a grudge against him while they got to see
him. So they would resent him.
Yeah, and that look that Burns gives him right before they're about to go into battle... It's like, you piece of shit.
Yeah.
But then it's also like, but you're my brother.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's a cool look. Speaking of Burns, Edward Burns, you know, he had a pretty interesting career. He kind of seemed like he would be like a heartthrob for a little bit. Like he might be like the leading man in like rom-coms.
Did you ever have the moments watching this movie where you're like, you look exactly like Ben Affleck?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And you're also just like too good looking.
Yes.
That's just him. Yeah, he's just kind of had an interesting career, varied, successful writer, director, actor credits, and he's most recently created the show Public Morals.
Yeah, Burns is in, like, he's made, like, five or six movies. He's really more known as, like, a director who puts himself in his own... He writes and directs and puts himself in his own movies. He kind of seems like, had he gone more in the direction of acting, and he's one of these guys, like Peter Berg, who shows up as an actor sometimes.
Right, right.
But Favreau. He seems like if he was a guy who had been like, I'm just going to be an actor, he probably could have done it. But he wanted to be more creative, so he directed a bunch of films. Still what he's doing, Public Morals. I'm not sure if it's still on. Goldberg's like one of those like above-average character actors who's just been around forever,
mm-hmm.
right? He's Eddie. He's Matt LeBlanc's roommate in an early season of Friends. Yeah, he's in Deja Vu. He's in Entourage.
I think he's one of the most underrated character actors out there because he's always fine.
Yeah, he's always good.
He's always good. He's always good. He doesn't ever steal the scene in the way that it takes away from the movie. And if he does steal a scene, it's because he does a great job. He talks a lot in Deja Vu. He does. God, his death is just incredible.
He's got a recurring role in the Jim Gaffigan show and in Fargo on FX.
Speaking of recurring roles, Barry Pepper, who played the sniper, awesome. He didn't work a lot. He worked on a lot until Saving Private Ryan, and then he kind of like drifted away. And in 2011, he appeared in The Kennedys.
Yeah, it was that TV series about the Kennedys. And then he's got a recurring role in The Maze Runner. He actually, of all the guys in this cast, he was one of the ones that I expected when I looked him up to see that he had like done very little work.
Yeah,
and I was surprised to find he's pretty consistently worked on reasonably high profile stuff since this movie. Mm-hmm. Like every couple of years he'll get something.
I think he should. He's great.
Yeah. Though I do think that he's probably the least developed of all of the GIs. He gets the least he gets his sort of prayer moments, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where he's shooting. And that's about it.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like there just needed to be a little bit more backstory, but the movie's already so long, they probably didn't have any. They could have maybe just switched lines around a little bit in some of those scenes.
Yeah.
Because in a lot of those scenes where they're all interacting, he's kind of just quiet.
I think
stoic.
He was in like a the sniper kind of movie.
Was it?
I think so, that he got after this maybe. In any case, yeah, Pepper. Ribisi, we talked about already. He was just in that brand new show, Sneaky Pete, the Amazon series, mm-hmm. that I've heard really good things about. But he was kind of like Diesel in the same way. Around 04 to 09, he kind of disappeared. He was in stuff, but it wasn't anything anyone was seeing. And then in 09 with Avatar, and he came back with Public Enemies. And then the last, you know, his last 7 or 8 years, he's been in a lot more stuff again.
Right.
But it's different now. He's an older character actor now. When in this role, and when he was younger, he was like really baby-faced and really sweet, and he had that soft voice. He's in Boiler Room. He's just that guy you liked.
Right. Paul Giamatti, I totally forgot, was in this.
Yeah.
Incredibly successful career. He's an Oscar winner.
He's in Billions now.
Yeah, straight out of Compton. He just popped up. That was like the first time I'd seen him in a while.
San Andreas, too.
Yeah, San Andreas, which I didn't really watch. Billions, like you said. And then this is an interesting thing because Paul Giamatti has an incredibly high RAR. We don't have the time to talk about RAR today. But I think there's a really big argument to make for Burns and Ribisi in this film.
Yeah, big time. We'll get to that. When we announce our new thing, guys, RAR is a whole discussion we're going to be having. You can postulate on what you think RAR is.
Yes.
Or go to Fist Pump Film Club, because I'd probably talk about it.
I'm sure you did.
And then Jeremy Davies, who I remember as Daniel Faraday from Lost. That's the role that I remember him for the most.
Remember hating him forever.
Yes. Fair enough.
Do you wonder if maybe his career did... Like, do you ever wonder about that?
Because
like, they take on a role that's so something.
Yeah.
That you just don't want to see him in things anymore?
Well, here's what's interesting about that. I have never seen Jeremy Davies in any of the shows I'm about to mention. He won an Emmy for Justified.
Right.
Just a few years ago. He was in Sleepy Hollow for a ton of episodes, Texas Rising, and he has 2 episodes in American Gods coming up. He's like a super prominent TV actor. I can't think of... I haven't seen his face other than Lost since the mid-2000s. But apparently,
I know when I looked up his picture, I was like, I don't know who this guy is other than in Lost.
Yeah. Aside from those guys, there were a bunch of other guys in this cast.
Cranston.
Yeah, Bryan Cranston shows up. Ted Danson shows up. Nathan Fillion. Did you realize that was him?
Yeah. So he's the kid.
He's the Wrong Ryan.
The Wrong Ryan. Yeah. What do I know him from?
Firefly and
just came
and
out.
Castle.
Yeah. I did recognize him though, and I was like, and that's also a really good scene. It's cool.
Yeah, really good scene.
All right. So moving on, we've got our categories. We'll break them down and let you guys know.
Yeah, there's three action movie categories, guys. Totally ridiculous, totally legitimate, and ridiculously legitimate. They are what they sound like. Totally ridiculous movies are like Con Air, Face Off. You just kind of like laugh the whole time. They're great, they're entertaining, but you know, they're really silly movies. Ridiculously legitimate's the middle category, and that's like Point Break, Predator, movies that are they are grounded, like The Rock, where they have a great couple performances maybe and a good solid plot, but they're silly too. You laugh unintentionally a lot. But they kind of hold together. They're right in the middle. And then totally legitimate movies are just what they sound like. They're classics.
Yeah.
And we even say movies like T2 is totally legit.
Absolutely.
It doesn't have
even
to
even Terminator was totally legit.
Yes. And I think it would be impossible to argue.
We would have to quit the show if we argued with anything otherwise.
This is totally legit. Yeah. It's real, real easy.
You guys are saying a lot of really nice stuff about us in the chat, about AMA and just us on the channel and our show and the network and all that. So we really appreciate it, guys. We really
Thanks,
do.
Guys. So last but not least, guys, we have one thing left, and that's called
The Pitch.
Wow. So couple things. First and foremost, follow along the conversation. Follow us on Twitter. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media.
You can find me at Andrew Guy.
You can find our Twitter for the show at AMA Podcast. And we are taking next week off. A well-deserved quick break, and it's mostly because Andrew's filming a fucking movie.
Yeah. Woo. Yeah, man. I am. I'm so excited. This is like the biggest thing that's ever happened to me in my life.
He's like a real thing. Like he's taking 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks off from life to go film the lead in this movie. He's going like we are doing like interesting pre-tapes to try to get our shows taped for the weeks that he's not here, because he's not available because he's going to be a movie star.
Be in studios, I'll be on location. I really can't. I can't wait. I'm going to miss the show next week.
Yeah.
But we will be pre-taping for the following week, and we've got a good one.
We've got a huge one.
And it's also coming out the same week that our second episode of the Schmodown is being released.
Yes, we come out. That episode comes out on May 2nd. So on May 3rd, you're going to be able to catch us here talking Mission Impossible 2.
With the cruise. Hunt.
Hunt.
Dougray Scott.
John Woo. Oh, man.
Oh, man. Probably the biggest miss in the franchise.
Easily the biggest miss in the franchise.
Although you hate number one.
I do. I mean, what I've realized is we're eventually going to cover both of them on this show. It's impossible. There's only like five more cruise movies we can actually, in good conscience, even cover on this show.
Right.
Like, that are actually movies that are relevant. It's like,
it's like Oblivion.
MI1, MI2. Yeah. If we wanted to cover Oblivion, yeah. I guess, you've got
War of the Worlds. I don't think you can cover.
No, you can cover War of the Worlds. Yeah. You can cover War of the Worlds. Somebody has suggested Night and Day several times. There's like Days of Thunder. Yeah. There's probably seven. The Mummy's coming up. But there's not
sweet.
Too many we get to cover still. So Mission Impossible 2 is the next one we got coming.
We don't want to burn through all of them. Oh, and really quick, guys, if you guys are... I'll be acting in it. If you guys legitimately are thinking about starting an AMA fan page on Instagram or Twitter or on Facebook, if you guys do a Facebook one, Ben and I will be happy to hop on there and interact with you guys. As for Twitter, you should probably just interact with our Twitter more because we can be better about that. But honestly, if you guys want to make an AMA Facebook page... we'll be happy to update you guys and pop in there.
100%.
It'd be amazing.
That'd be so
fun. We
would
love that.
Yeah, it'd be great. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Thanks for watching. This has been another excellent episode of Action Movie Anatomy. And yeah, we've covered like... how many of your favorite movies in this category, of the action category, are left? I feel like when we walked into the show, you would have said The Patriot, Gladiator, Saving Private Ryan... Inception, The Dark Knight.
Yeah, might have said Last Samurai.
Lord of the
well.
Rings, Last Samurai. Those
Con Air would have been in there.
Yeah.
And The Rock, yeah.
That's like your golden list almost.
Probably for action movies.
For me, the one big glaring omission we're still working on is Heat.
Which I bought the other day at 7-Eleven. I did. I saw the $5 Heat. It was the first thing I saw when I walked in. I was like, boom.
It's
mine.
My eighth favorite movie of all time, Heat. And, we're going to cover that soon. That's coming up. Guys, this is episode 96. Four episodes left to episode 100.
Yeah, and there are those omitted episodes, the watch-alongs and the best of and the Bill Paxton, but there's four more until 100. There's a month until we have our big episode.
Episode 100. So we won't be here next week, guys, but find us on Twitter, watch the old episodes, tweet at us, let us know your thoughts, and look forward to Mission Impossible 2. Thank you so much for watching. Thank you for listening, and we will see you guys when we see you.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.